was at Little Rock Air Force Base, guarding the weapons storage area around midnight, when a new set of officers came on duty. Green was told that he could go home. Before leaving, he stopped by Central Security Control to see if anybody needed help. He bumped into another security officer, Sergeant Jimmy Roberts, who'd come there for the same reason. Roberts worked across the hall from Green, and the two were friends. They both felt like being useful. It was a busy night. A third security officer walked into the office and asked for a map. He was supposed to escort a flatbed truck carrying an all-terrain forklift to Launch Complex 3747, but didn't know how to get there. The job sounded pretty urgent. They needed the forklift to haul light all units onto the complex so that the PTS team could see what they were doing. Green and Roberts said they'd be glad to escort the flatbed. They knew the way and could get the forklift out there fast. Instead of going home and getting into bed, they got into a pickup and headed to Damascus. Colonel Moser left the missile potential hazard net and used the security police net to speak directly with Morris. It was almost 1 in the morning and a decision had been made. He told Morris that 3 airmen should put on REFCO suits. A checklist had been prepared, and Moser wanted him to copy it down word for word. Morris grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil, and while sitting in the front seat of Brock Smith's truck, copied down the instructions. It was the same checklist that the command post had prepared 2 hours earlier, except that the 200 ppm fuel vapor limit had been raised to 250 ppm. Morris spent 15 minutes listening carefully and writing down exactly what Moser said. They finished, and then Moser paused, told him to stand by, and signed off. Morris sat in the truck, waiting. 20 minutes later, Colonel Moser was on the radio again. There was a slight change of plan. Instead of entering the silo, the 2 airmen in REFCOs should enter the control center. Moser stressed that the men should avoid passing through any fuel vapor. He didn't want anyone to get hurt. And he passed along General Levitt's instructions that no electrical switch should be turned on or off without permission from SAC headquarters. Colonel Morris left the truck, gathered the members of PTS Team B, and read them the final checklist. He went through every step, and he said, "We don't want any heroes out there. We'll do exactly what's on the paper, and that's all, and then we're all going to come back." "Colonel, this is unreal," Jeff Kennedy said. Kennedy could not believe that this was the plan. It was insane. It made absolutely no sense to send men into the launch complex through the access portal instead of the escape hatch. The access portal was a much more dangerous route. If you went through the escape hatch, the trip to the control center would be quick and direct, and you wouldn't have to open any blast doors with a goddamn hand pump. If you went through the escape hatch, you'd be protected by the blast doors, not impeded by them. And the escape hatch was on the opposite side of the complex from the missile. The access portal was a lot closer to the missile. Why send anyone in there? Of course, you'd have to sample for fuel vapor every step of the way. You'd be in danger every step of the way. To reach the control center, the men would have to pass through the blast lock, and it was full of fuel vapor 6 hours ago when PTS Team A opened the door a crack, took a peek, and then had to slam it shut. Why send anyone down the longest, most dangerous, most likely to be contaminated route? Kennedy thought this checklist must have been written by somebody who'd never set foot on a Titan II complex. "Of course you can fit a man in REFCO through the escape hatch," Kennedy argued. "He'd just been through the escape hatch, so he ought to know." "Kennedy, this is the plan," Morris said. "This is the plan that's come down, and that's it. End of discussion." Sergeant Hansen had selected the 3 men who'd enter the complex and the 3 who would wait in REFCOs, halfway down the access road as backup. Kennedy wasn't one of them. Kennedy and Hansen didn't get along. Hansen wished Kennedy had returned to the base with the rest of PTS Team A. As team chief, Hansen was in charge of this operation. He didn't think you could fit through the escape hatch in a Refco. He liked the checklist, and if Kennedy didn't, that was too bad. David Livingston, Greg Devlin, and Rex Huckle, a farm boy from Kansas, climbed into the back of a pickup truck wearing their Refcos. Colonel Morris got into the front seat along with Hansen and Captain George Short, chief of the field maintenance branch at the 308th. Before the truck drove down the road to the complex, Jeff Kennedy jumped into the back. Outside the gate, Livingston, Devlin, and Huckle drew straws to see who would be the first to go in. Walking over to the exhaust vent alone as fuel vapor poured out of it seemed like a brave thing to do. All of them were willing, but this felt like the best way to choose. David Livingston drew the short straw. Before anyone could enter the launch complex, a hole had to be cut in the chain-link fence. The gate was still locked, nobody had the key, and climbing over the fence in a Refco could tear the suit. Morris, Hansen, and Short spent about 15 minutes making a hole with bolt cutters. They finished at 2 in the morning. Livingston put on his helmet and his air pack and prepared to go in. Although the pack was designed to hold an hour's worth of air, the command post had instructed that it should be used for just half an hour. The air packs were considered unreliable, and running out of air amid a thick cloud of fuel vapor could kill you. Hansen and Morris got into the front seat of the truck. Morris would stay in touch with the command post on the security police net, and Hansen would talk to Livingston on the radio network at the launch complex. The two radio systems were incompatible. If General Levitt wanted to give Livingston an order, Levitt would have to tell Moser, who would have to tell Morris, who would have to tell Hansen, who would have to tell Livingston. Although Hansen had brought along a repeater to strengthen the signal, reception on the complex was spotty. Carrying a flashlight and a vapor detector, Livingston went through the hole in the fence. He saw a cloud of white vapor streaming from the silo's exhaust vents, like steam from a boiling kettle. He entered the complex, crossed the gravel near the hard stand, and approached one of the vents. Hansen had told him to get the vapor detector as close as possible to the cloud, without getting engulfed in it if the wind shifted. Livingston stuck the probe into the mist, and the needle on the gauge shot all the way to the right. "The portable vapor detector has pegged out," Livingston said. Hansen told Morris, who informed the command post. The news was shared with everyone on the net.